realized I may have made it too easy on you. But I also realized that sometimes I ask questions and no one really knows what I'm looking for. So, the obvious answer to what do all the mysteries have in common is Deuteronomy 29:29, I think, says that the secret things belong to God. So, one of the things that all the mysteries have in common is that they have to be revealed. They require revelation. So, I didn't want someone to cheat. We'll take a closer look at that next week. But that is the most obvious thing that all the mysteries have in common. Okay, is the mic okay? All right. It was pretty hot last week. All right, last week we were talking about the image in Daniel chapter 2. Excuse me. The image in Daniel chapter 2. And we focused on the feet, which were of iron and earthenware or potted clay. And the reason we did that is because that part of the vision is kind of unique to that particular vision. You have to tease out the fulfillment of it, looking at later visions, etc. The head of gold, the chest and arms of silver, etc. Though all those things are expanded upon later in later visions, but the feet and the miry clay are not. So I'll just wrap up a couple things from that, and then we'll push on with Babylonian history. And next week we'll hopefully tie all this stuff together. You may recall this slide. It filled the whole slide last time, but this is a view of the globe. If you take all of Europe and all of its colonies, this globe indicates how much of the world Europe conquered. And we're talking about the power of fulfilled prophecy. I don't know how far this goes, but Genesis 9:27 does say, "May God enlarge Japheth." And the Indo-Europeans, based on the list of nations there we have in the table of nations in Genesis chapter 10, we see obviously the Medes and the Persians and the Greeks. All those people speak Indo-European languages. And if you just look at this globe, the way we have it here, it's pretty impressive. But it's not actually the truth. This map is actually the truth. This is a map that color codes all of the colonial empires to the nation. The detail isn't what's important here. You probably see that the red is Britain. It's got the eastern United States, Canada, etc. But this is the reality. So what does this speak to? In my mind, the first map speaks to the strength of the iron. The Germanic Europe that emerged out of late antiquity after the conquest of the Western Roman Empire had the strength of the iron. And we'll see when we get to chapter 7, we have the first description of that fourth beast, which is the Roman Empire. It crushes and breaks and tramples everything. It has its iron. It crushes everything. So the Germanic tribes that coalesced into the medieval nations had the strength of the iron, but what they lacked was the unity of the Roman Empire, the cohesiveness. That's why we spent some time talking about language, and it does factor into the book of Daniel. But that map shows how strong they were, but this map shows how fractious they were. If you've read enough ancient history, you might be reading that this happened during the Bronze Age, this happened during the Iron Age. And those ages will be further divided into like early Bronze Age, middle Bronze Age, late Bronze Age. And then those might be further subdivided into, say, middle Bronze Age 1 or middle Bronze Age 2. And sometimes that'll be subdivided into middle Bronze Age 1A or 1B, et cetera, et cetera. The ages themselves are named after the most prominent or prevalent used metal for weapons, technology, etc. And the early, middle, and late speaks to advances within that technology. But then the numbers and the letters that subdivide it are based on the pottery. And the reason is that even though earthenware ceramic is fairly fragile, it'll last forever. So I can break a ceramic plate, and those shards will remain until the Lord comes. Nothing will eat them or dissolve them. They're just as durable. In fact, in some ways, they're more durable than the metals, because the metals will corrode. So I think what this is speaking to is the fact that any attempt at unity within Europe is doomed to fail. It says, the promise there in Daniel chapter 2 is they would not adhere to one another. So as much as some pan-continental unification movement might try to bring them together, that latent tribalism is always going to reemerge. Now, that's not specifically what's unique about Germanic Europe, because I could go to any continent with the exception of Australia, which is kind of a exception in a lot of ways. But a lot of continents are like that. There's just too much diversity for a cohesive unified whole to emerge from any of those continents. What separated the Germanic tribes and nations was the strength of the iron. Because there were Celtic peoples that were in Europe when the Romans came along. They were fully subsumed by either the Romans or the Germans. But only these two identities remained. So we have Latin Europe and we have Germanic Europe. And those are basically your two options with some really small, basically insignificant minorities other than those two. So those are basically your two options. And that speaks to what we're really talking about in this whole book, which is identity and union. And so when you get to that iron mixed with clay, you have two identities that are fighting one another. You have Rome, and then you have Germans. Now just remember when I said geography is destiny. That's because our geography kind of determines our national character in a lot of ways. People that identified as Romans have their origins in an urban setting, in a city. And this isn't urban versus rural like you might think. The Germans all have their origins in a collection of tribes. And so it's more about the nature of a city versus the nature of tribes. A city is cosmopolitan. And that changes its worldview and its outlook. It changes the way it uses resources. It changes the way that entire society develops. A tribe, by definition, is basically provincial. Its view is more narrow and focused. And in some ways, myopic and xenophobic. When you think of a city and you think of Rome in particular, and you think in terms of universalism, globalism, it's this idea that we can all be this one thing. And think about this. In the last centuries of the Roman Empire, there were tens of millions of people who lived and died thinking of themselves as Romans. And not a single one of them ever set foot in that city. And yet they identified as Romans. The Germans and tribal peoples in general are more parochial in their outlook. They're not universalists. So as time goes on and we have the Western Empire fall, this Roman identity becomes Catholic. That Roman identity is subsumed by Catholicism and adherence to that religion. But that tribalism has a modern analog, which is nationalism. So we talked about the EU and Brexit and all that stuff. Anytime, because Britain's an island, it's always going to be on the leading edge of breaking up these kind of European Union movements. So really, when you think of the Catholic Union, it's really another attempt at unifying Europe under one banner. And that's just works in cycles. It just works in cycles. There'll be these movements to squash these national identities, for people to think of themselves as Roman or to think of themselves as just Europeans, etc. But these nationalistic identities are always going to reemerge. They're always going to be there. And sometimes it just takes something to light the fuse. So that latent tribal identity is always there and always will be. If you remember Genesis 11, 6 through 7, this goes all the way back to Babel. You'll recall the Bible says that the people were what? They were one. And they all spoke in one language. So remember I said language is culture. All God had to do to break up that culture, that civilization, was confuse its language. Because language is culture. It wasn't just that they couldn't communicate. It was that they can't relate to one another anymore. When you speak a different language, you start thinking in different ways. And its reverse is Isaiah 11, 10 through 12. And I'll just go ahead and read that real quick. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, who shall stand as a banner to the people. For the Gentiles shall seek him, and his resting place shall be glorious. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left, from Assyria and Egypt, from Pathros and Cush, from Elam and Shinar, from Hamath and the islands of the sea. He will set up a banner for the nations, and he will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. God planted his banner on the day of Pentecost, and he was doing that to progressively call out his tribe, his own special people, from among the nations that he had scattered at Babel. And it's a direct reversal. When you look at Genesis 11 with the tower, you'll notice that God divided their tongues and confused them, and they scattered. On the day of Pentecost, divided tongues came down as flames, and the people were confused because why? Because they could understand the gospel in their own native languages. God, that was the beginning of God reversing what he had done at Babel. Because the pattern is this: when mankind unites, they tend to do so in opposition to God. Period. As they come together, things begin to wax worse and worse, more and more in direct opposition to God. God is tribal in this respect because he's called us out to be his own special people, separate from all of that, separate from the world and separate from the nations. And it's the nations that are going to, of course, be destroyed when he puts an end to all rule, power, and authority. But what he's doing starting at Pentecost is calling us out in his own way, by his own method, on his own terms. Not the terms that people at Babel were using, not the terms that any number of conquerors throughout history have used. He's calling us in his own name and in his own specific way. And so when we look at this book and we look at the first chapter, for instance, it's a matter of identity and union. What Nebuchadnezzar is trying to do with the Jews, the young men there, is he's trying to get them to identify no longer as Jews, but as Babylonians. And that is something that the city of Babylon had been very good at in times past, was making people adjust their unity and adjust their sense of loyalty from whatever they were before to Babylonian. And when you look at the book of Revelation, there's sealing and markings going on throughout that book, and it's a question of identity. Who belongs to who? Are you the beasts or are you the lambs? Whose table are you going to sup at, and whose cup are you going to drink from, Christ or Belial's? Who is your master? On and on throughout the Bible, the Lord is asking us to pick which one, which side of this fence are we going to be on? And that's the same question that was presented to David and to Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego time and time again throughout the book of Daniel. And what did they always choose? They always chose to identify as Jews, as belonging to the Lord, as his own special people of that age. And really, that's all that's ever going to be asked of us, is to choose for ourselves this day whom we will serve. All right, anything on that before we press on? All right, enough thinking. We'll just do some a brief history of Babylon. And it'll set the stage for chapter 4. We'll get into the meat of chapter 4 and the vision of the tree next week. Babylon, the city of Nebuchadnezzar, was over 1,000 years old when he came to rule. And it does have a relationship to the original Babel in that it's a namesake. It's similar to York, Connecticut being a namesake of York, England, or New York being the namesake of York. And you can, humans do that all the time. And the importance of that is that it's a legacy that's carried forward through time. So when you read about Babylon in the prophets, for instance, you not only need to think about literal Babylon, but a lot of that stuff can be equally applied to spiritual Babylon in the New Testament time, or in this case, Rome. Isaiah 47:13, for instance, parallels exactly what we read in Revelation 9:21 with mysticism and sorceries, etc., etc. Both of those cities were known for that. And, of course, mysticism would pervade the Catholic Church and the superstitions of that era, et cetera, et cetera. Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar's time was founded in the late 3rd millennium B.C., probably a few hundred years after the Babel incident. And it was founded, the only way we know where Akkad was, Akkad is a city we haven't found yet, but we do know that they were within sight of each other. And the city of Babylon, as it was then, borrowed a lot of Akkadian culture. I'm not going to talk about the Akkadians very much. But the language of Babylonia was Akkadian, and that was the official language that all their documents were written in, etc. And it was just a minor city-state. This doesn't mean it was a cow town or a place where Hicks lived, but it was just a minor city-state. And it developed over time, and the reason it developed was because of what's called the first Babylonian dynasty. This would be Hammurabi and his immediate ancestors. 5 or 6 kings ruled before Hammurabi. They chose Babylon as their dynasty, probably because it was close to Akkad. And Hammurabi's famous for a few things, his law code. And he probably died around the time that Moses was born. Both of their law codes famously have an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in it. What Hammurabi did was he took a lot of the traditional laws of Mesopotamia and just wrote them down and codified them. So he was famous for those things. But the most remarkable thing about his reign was, keep in mind, in his reign, roughly around the time of Joseph-ish, maybe a little later, there were cities that were well-established in southern Mesopotamia, and several of them were considered holy. And, you know, these ancient traditions, they stick fast and hard. But within his reign, within his lifetime, Babylon sucked up all those traditions, and from that point on, it was the holy city of southern Mesopotamia. Also very much like Rome, which no one really associates with any kind of particular holiness or anything like that, no more than any other city, but it of course became the holy city of Roman Catholicism. The other thing about Hammurabi's reign is that just within his lifetime, the people of the surrounding region started thinking of themselves as Babylonians. And like I said, many of them were members of other older, more prestigious cities in the sense of their own legacies, but they began thinking of themselves as Babylonians. And basically, the word Babylonia became another name for southern Mesopotamia. Assyria was northern Mesopotamia, and those people all identified as Assyrians. And really, from Hammurabi's time forward, that's your two main social identities. You're either an Assyrian or a Babylonian, and of course those two cultures would hate each other. They were kind of like the English and the French of the Bronze Age. Then they entered a middle period after Hammurabi. After Hammurabi died, his empire collapsed within a couple decades because His sons just were not him. And Babylonia became dominated by these various social groups. In turn, Assyria, Elam, Kassites, and Arameans. There was obviously a lot of back and forth in there, but the Arameans moved in around the time of David. And one of those tribes were called the Chaldeans. And they became so pervasive in southern Babylon, especially around the parts of ancient Sumer where Ur was, that Ur became known as Ur of the Chaldees. And the Chaldeans then kind of basically just insinuated themselves into the culture and eventually took it over, so much so that the educated classes eventually became known as Chaldeans. So we see that also in the book of Daniel. Semi-famous people, Merodach Baladan from the time of Hezekiah there in 2 Kings 20 and Isaiah 39. Famously, he sent a messenger to Hezekiah because Hezekiah had gotten well, and he was probably fishing for an ally against Assyria. And what did Hezekiah do? Showed him all his wealth. And what did God think of that? Yep. And not only that, but what did God promise? By Babylon. So long before Babylon was Babylon, as we think of it with Nebuchadnezzar, it was already foretold that they were going to be an instrument. They were continuously rebelling against the Assyrians, and the city was completely razed in 689 BC, and that's only about 40 or 50 years, before Nebuchadnezzar was born. So the Babylon that Nebuchadnezzar grew up in and took over was basically a brand new city, but what remained was the mystique and the legacy of Babylon. In fact, brings us to the Chaldean dynasty. Nabopolassar was Nebuchadnezzar's father. He was actually an official within the Assyrian administration. He took over Babylon and set himself up as a king there eventually. The last strong Assyrian king was Ashurbanipal, and after he died, his sons and some generals, they just waged a constant warfare for 20-some years. You know, those kind of things are so stupid because these guys are fighting for the Assyrian throne, and meanwhile, the Babylonians and the Medes and the Sumerians and the Scythians are literally just gobbling up pieces of that empire, and you sit there and wonder, you know, if you guys don't get yourselves together, there's not going to be anything left. But that's exactly what they did. They just continued to fight each other and let the Chaldeans and the Medes eat up their empire. So he allied with the Medes and eventually took over pretty quickly, and I won't say easily, there were some tough battles in there. And then his son Nebuchadnezzar took over, probably as a general around the year 610, 609. So I think, if I remember correct, the Battle of Megiddo that killed Josiah, what Josiah was trying to do was block the Egyptians from joining the Assyrians. What had happened is the Chaldeans, Nebuchadnezzar, excuse me, had surrounded the city of Haran, and that's where the remnants of the Assyrian army and power were, and the Egyptian pharaoh Necho was trying to relieve that siege, and Josiah was trying to stop it, and he famously died after a fierce battle was fought at Megiddo. Eventually, Necho went up there, and it didn't make much of a difference. So Nebuchadnezzar would fight with the Egyptians for some time, but for most of his early career, Nebuchadnezzar was very energetic. He was relatively young when he took over. He was only about 30 years old when his father died. And he's responsible for often what's called Babylonian Renaissance and Revival. Massive spending programs to build up Babylon and the cities of Samaria, temples, things like that, irrigation projects just on huge, massive scales. And he was also a very capable general. So this was a flourishing, once again, of old Babylonian traditional culture. They even started using old-timey language, I guess you could say. They started using Old Akkadian as their official governmental language for correspondence and things like that. He was really big into reaching far deep into the past and bringing it forward to his own time. And it was all about look how grand we are. We've been around a long time, and we're still here. He was followed by his son, Amel-Marduk, and he's known for the Babylonian reversal. Now, historians call this a reversal because he undoes a lot of his father's policies, but part of me thinks that he actually was more in line with his father towards the end of his life. The process that Nebuchadnezzar goes through in the first five chapters, or the first four chapters of Daniel, are all about making him recognize God's sovereignty. That's basically the theme of the book. And what does Nebuchadnezzar eventually do at the end of the fourth chapter? He writes a letter, and he admits that God is sovereign. It's significant enough. I'll go ahead and read part of that. Verse 34, at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? Verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to put down. So after after Nebuchadnezzar's experience, it's quite possible that he did completely reform himself. It's also quite possible that one day when you and I are in heaven, Nebuchadnezzar is going to be there. Can't say that for sure. That's for the Lord to judge. But if Amel-Duk continued in his father's policies, it was his brother-in-law who wanted to go back to the way it had been before. Yes, Randy?
His Renaissance means great accomplishment. Was that done by taxation?
Conquest and taxation, yeah.
So they had a commerce in the land so taxes could be exacted.
Right. They were still basically collecting tributes for the most part. But conquest funded most of this stuff, especially in the early years. There is some information that, you know, they sucked up a lot of the wealth of that part of the world just to produce Babylon itself. And so he was beggaring entire regions in order to enrich Babylon. But he extended his projects outward to a good deal of southern Mesopotamia as well. Anything else? The next king was Nergal-Sarnessar, and he was Nebuchadnezzar's son-in-law. And whatever Amel-Marduk is evil Merodach, by the way, in the Old Testament, he didn't like how things were going, so he basically went back to the way Nebuchadnezzar had done them in the early days of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And things continued to pace from there. He died in 556. And his son, who was just a boy, became king, and he only reigned for 9 months before he was killed in a coup. And that brings us to Nabonidus, who was the last official king. His son was Belshazzar. Nabonidus was kind of a simple soldier. He didn't care much for administration and politics. So he actually, once Belshazzar was of age, he left most of that stuff to Belshazzar. Then he went off and made war, or he went off and restored this temple or that temple. But he's the last official king, and he kind of went into semi-retirement until the last war with the Persians and Medes kind of broke upon their frontier. Excuse me. That, in a nutshell, is the history of the Chaldean dynasty. Nebuchadnezzar is referred to as Belshazzar's father in the sense of ancestor. We don't know exactly what the relationship between Nabonidus and Belshazzar was, but we're probably getting into, like, you know, sisters, brothers, cousins. This dynasty just wasn't very fertile, I guess you could say. So they were really starting to reach for relatives and things like that. But what they were really reaching for was men of quality. One of the things these men had in common was that none of them even came close to rivaling Nabopolassar and Nebuchadnezzar in energy, intelligence, vision, things like that. Nabopolassar and Nebuchadnezzar were kind of the type of guys you see build empires throughout history, and their descendants were the type of guys you see destroy empires. So think David and Solomon versus Rehoboam. That's kind of the way those things work. Any thoughts, questions, comments? Randy. Definitely. Daniel's position was not unique. Well, it was unique in the sense of the status he attained, but Nebuchadnezzar was looking for talent. And that's kind of the way these massive empires have to work, is they have to work through bureaucracies. So the idea is you bring in a bunch of young men who can spend their whole careers working for you, and then you make them eunuchs so that they're married to their jobs, and then they that's all they do for the rest of their life is just do that job. And they tend to become better administrators than the nominal kings who are actually ruling. But it is kind of just you're trying to gather as much talent as you possibly can and then let the cream rise to the crop. And when the Persians took over, they basically adopted the Babylonian system of administration. And even though the Persians are famous for having, I don't know, four or five capitals, Babylon was the administrative capital of the empire for a long time. And Alexander the Great, a couple hundred years later, had the same ideas. In fact, Alexander died in Nebuchadnezzar's palace several hundred years later. So, but yeah, that's a good point. Anything else? Okay. Nebuchadnezzar was Nabopolassar's son. Amel-Marduk, who is called Evil Merodach in the Old Testament, is Nebuchadnezzar's son. Ner-Glisser is Nebuchadnezzar's son-in-law. And then the last, Labashi-Marduk, he was the son of Ner-Glisser, but he was executed as a young boy. And then the palace coup that overtook him, they gave the throne to Nabonidus. So we know what the relationship between those first few are. Nabonidus was probably related somehow. I mean, he was a commander in the army, so he was probably some type of distant relationship. But things were already starting to fall apart, and so when these dynasties start killing each other or there starts being coups against them, it's usually because things are starting to slip. And Nabonidus contributed to that with just his absenteeism. He just really was not interested in running an empire, and his son was apparently not splendid at it either. So, anything else? We talked quite a bit in the first week about the prophets, the late prophets who did most of the writing in the last half of the Old Testament. And obviously we can't do anything exhaustive here, but Isaiah and Jeremiah had a lot to say about Babylon. Isaiah obviously looking forward, and Jeremiah obviously lived through these times, at least through the destruction. And the book of Jeremiah is not a fun read. I mean, it is very unpleasant to read that book. What he went through personally was horrific in many instances, but really just watching someone who starts as a young man and spends his whole life trying to get people on board with doing the right thing, even as his country was being surrounded and overwhelmed repeatedly by successive Babylonian invasions, they just would not get their act together, ever, and they certainly weren't going to do so in a godly manner. So we talked about the golden head, the head of gold. And when we go through that list of kingdoms there in Daniel chapter 2, it says that a second will arise after you, inferior to you. Well, Isaiah 14:4 calls Babylon the golden city. And there's various expressions similar to that. It's called the glory of kingdoms in Isaiah 13, 19. It's called the lady of the kingdoms in Isaiah 47 and 5. Abundant in treasures, Jeremiah 51, 13. And the praise of the whole earth, Jeremiah 51, 41. And time doesn't allow us to go through all the ancient historians who just had nothing but splendid things to say about the city of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar was the one who built the famous Hanging Gardens, which were one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, according to the Greeks, etc., etc. They had walls that you could race four chariot teams across. Just these huge walls, and they just literally thought they were impregnable. And the ancient prophets testified to that. They said, you think you're going to sit there behind your great walls and be safe? And what did the Persians famously do? They went under the walls. So God always has his ways of humbling people, as we see with Nebuchadnezzar. He has his ways of humbling cities and civilizations. These verses here all speak of Babylon as a useful instrument at times of God's wrath. In every great house, there are vessels both of honor and dishonor. God was using Babylon to humble Judah, to punish them for their wickedness. These verses testify to that. But like the Assyrians, who did all their work for the Lord with evil intent, so did the Babylonians. So God promised that it was going to fall. Now that expression, Babylon is fallen, is in the prophetic perfect, which means as soon as God declared it, it's as if it has already happened. And that's the remarkable thing about God's prophecies concerning Babylon and really anything, is that as soon as God says it's going to happen, it might as well already have. We tend to take things linearly and in our own times, but God has this perfect view of the end from the beginning, and he knows the right time to strike. He always does. So I asked last week the question, why does God work the way he does? Why do things take him so long, et cetera, et cetera? I think it's part of the mysteries, but it's also part of just our faith. That knowing that God knows exactly what he's doing, that he's going to do everything according to his will, and it's going to work out. Their conquerors were predicted. Now, in Isaiah, it refers to them often as Elam, but that's because Persians may have probably not meant anything to the Israelites of Isaiah's day. But one of the capitals was Susa, and Daniel gets one of his visions there actually later in the book. So Elam, where Cyrus was actually born in Elam, or close to there, came from there. And actually Darius the Mede was leading the armies that led into Babylon the night of the feast of Belshazzar. So the humiliation of Babylon in many ways mirrors the humiliation of Nebuchadnezzar, with one key difference. There's hope for Nebuchadnezzar, I think. If the last verses of chapter 4 are any indication, I have some hope for Nebuchadnezzar. There's no hope for Babylon, not literally or its spiritual successor. So when we go through these books, what we want to do is look for ways that the one mirrors the other, but also mirrors things going on in Roman history and the book of Revelation as well. Anything else before we close? Gerald. Right. I appreciate that. Next week, as we go through chapter 4, if you want to read through chapter 4, that would be helpful and familiarize with itself. We're going to go through the vision. The vision itself is actually kind of simple. So we'll kind of go through that pretty quick. What's really going on is what's a little bit more fascinating, and it's essentially we have Nebuchadnezzar on trial, and we're going to compare that to a court scene that we see in chapter 7 and then in the book of Revelation. We'll hopefully try to start synthesizing these things with the theme, of course, that God reigns over all the kingdoms of men. All right, thank you.